And here we are again. This is Lorenzo Elin on The Production Specialist, a podcast series of personal accounts from individuals and companies in emerging and frontier production industries. Flipbooks have always intrigued me as a kid. Drawings that vary gradually from page to page are all stacked together. And when flipped through in quick succession, the images appear to animate by simulating motion. On today's episode, we have Chris Savé, a traditional animator from Canada. He has worked on some amazing projects ranging from Disney classics, such as Pocahontas and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, to the new Mary Poppins movie. We have a lot in store for you, so sit back and enjoy. Welcome, Chris.
When I was really young, I would draw a lot. And it would help me just kind of relax. And, you know, I did sports and that kind of stuff too. But, you know, I love to draw. And when I was probably 12, my parents bought me this big hardcover book called The Art of Walt Disney. Because they knew I I would draw all the time. And they thought, okay, Walt Disney, that's drawings. And they gave it to me for my birthday. And I kind of fell in love with that book. And I would draw from it, meticulously draw. I actually still have the drawings now from when I was like a kid. But I would take like 2 hours and sit there and meticulously draw these animated characters out of this book. For whatever reason, I got this joy from it. And I think it was just something I could just focus on and just lose myself in. So that's what kind of started it. And I was very lucky that by the time I got into high school, I had a kind of a progressive high school that actually had an animation course in it and a film arts course in it. And when I was in 11th grade, you know, it's like, wow, I can take a course in animation and making films instead of like, you know, math or sure, I'll do that. And so I did, and I got a little taste of it there. But before you graduated, just as part of the high school, would give us tours of the local colleges and universities. And in Oakville, which is about, you know, a half hour drive away, there's a big college there, and it has a world-renowned animation course in it. And I, with a bunch of classmates on a day trip, went to visit Sheridan College. And I got to admit, I was kind of floored that there was an animation course. And I was also floored that you could actually do that for a living. I think it's funny now that I didn't even consider it as a career. And that's where it kind of launched, right? It launched from there. But I don't see my career as one of those things where I was toiling away and then suddenly got a big break and then boom, everything started happening. Mine has been kind of one step at a time. Bump, bump, bump.
Straight out of college, Chris had the chance to work for a big studio called Nelvana in Toronto, where he worked on a TV show.
It was an experience. I just kind of rolled into it. It was one of those things where I kind of just went, oh, okay, let's see what this is like. And I showed up at work the first day and they told me what to draw. And I went, okay. And I had to, you know, I had to kind of figure it out on the job like everybody does. And I'm sure I was nervous, but you just, you know, I would kind of peek over at how other people are doing things and you go, okay, let's do that. And you do your best.
Wait, I think I know this phrase. Fake it till you make it. Loving the hustle.
And you listen to your directors, you know, when they tell you, hey, maybe you should do this a little more like this. You go, okay, and you just do that.
Chris ended up being at Nelvana a few months until he followed his girlfriend to another city. After working nearly 7 years in the industry as an animator for feature films, TV shows, and commercials, he received an unexpected call out of the blue.
Yeah. So let's say 94, I'd been in the business now for about 7 years. And I had, you know, I'd done well, worked on some features, worked on a lot of shows, worked on this, you know, Ren and Stimpy, the show Ren and Stimpy. I'd worked on a movie called Fern Gully, which, you know, were kind of bigger productions and well-known. And then a bunch of other stuff. I got a call out of the blue, to tell you the truth. I was at home, me and my girlfriend that was now my wife. We got a call from a gentleman named Roy Conley, a big producer at Disney Feature Animation, and said, hey, they would like me to send my portfolio down there because they're interested in hiring me. I've come to find out later that it was a few friends of mine that had got hired at Disney earlier than that. And they kind of said, hey, maybe you should give this guy a call. At the time, Disney Feature Animation was trying to expand their production output. They were trying to go from one movie a year to two movies a year. Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, you know, these movies were hit movies, and they were going, wow, you know, if we doubled our production, you know, that would be a good thing, you know. So that's what they did. So I worked on Pocahontas and then Hunchback right after that. Yeah.
Yeah is right. So having looked at animation myself, there are many different types. You have 3D animation, stop motion, motion capture, and many other options. Chris is specialized in traditional or hand-drawn or 2D type animation. This animation type was a dominant form of animation until the advent of computer animation. So just like how a flipbook is created, an animator has to use a variety of techniques to create a believable picture, such as the use of timing and spacing. And of course, being good at drawing. But unlike a normal live-action film, Chris basically plays a role of the actor and character that he's drawing. So naturally, many things come into play here.
The performance of the character, that falls to the animators to do, yes. That is probably the most important thing that an animator contributes to any animated film. They become the actors, essentially, in the movie. So they give the performance. They're directed by the director, like a live action movie would be. You have to give that performance, the acting, the facial expression, the whole performance, the whole thing.
So what about hiring real actors to come in and perform so that you have something to draw off of? Otherwise, it can seem incredibly difficult to picture precise movements.
Occasionally that happens. Yeah, occasionally people will use it as reference, or they might do it themselves. They might like put a camera up and film themselves doing a certain movement, and then they use it as reference. It's best used as reference and not used as completely taking it. I don't do that very often. Personally, I don't. I know some animators that do it often. I almost never do that. It's just a process of working, you know.
Sorry, Chris, I cut you off. You still had some more fundamentals to bring up.
You would study action analysis. You study how does a four-legged animal walk? How do those four legs work to get an animal to walk like that? You study that kind of stuff. How does a person walk? How does that weight transfer happen? So there's then caricature of that, because sometimes it's not realistic. Sometimes it's cartoony and wacky and weird. In that regard, you're studying other cartoons and seeing how they did it. There's a certain artistic caricature that happens not only to the way it looks, but to the way it moves. And then you would study posing, called silhouetting or lines of action. You'll see like actors, dancers, they all study this kind of stuff too. You know, you've seen dancers on stage where they hit poses. Actors, live action actors, do the same thing. They got to hit their marks and hit poses and make sure they read. So like if I have a thing where I have to pick up a cup, if I pick it up a certain way, if I do it the wrong way, the audience might not even see it. Like I got to hold it out, you know, where people can see it if they're supposed to see it, you know. Things like that, getting things to be able to be seen well and read well. That's posing and the fundamentals of posing. And then after all that, you pour that into a performance. And so you're studying people and personalities and how people react in certain things and how to act like an actor would. You know, how do people react when they're mad? What kind of faces do they make when they're, you know, expressions and body language? You study that sort of thing. Then the nitty gritty comes in of, like you said, spacing. Spacing is just basically how much you move something from frame to frame. The more space between something, the faster it's moving.
To further along the point of timing and spacing, since film is run at 24 frames per second, as you drop a ball from your hand, gravity naturally accelerates the ball until it hits the floor and bounces back up. Within animation, to simulate acceleration, the ball needs to grow in distance from its previous frame. For example, at frame 1, the ball hasn't moved. At frame 2, it has moved 1 centimeter. At frame 3, the ball has now moved 3 centimeters. And as the film's frame rate doesn't change, the perceived movement shows growing speed. On a usual project, Chris is only tasked with creating the animation of a character. He isn't part of the character design, and the coloring or shading of the character in post. Think of it as a skeleton.
With Ratcliffe, I was just an animator at that time. I had come into Pocahontas when it was going into animation. So by the time animation starts, all that stuff has to be already designed and complete. Because you can't be designing it while you're... It's kind of like if you go in a movie and you're shooting a movie, it's like you have to make sure your set's all made up and all your clothes, you know, all the...
However, unless you're a supervising animator, then you're most likely part of the character design as well.
Other films that I've worked on as a supervising animator, yes, I'm part of the process of design. Generally, animators aren't always part of the design process, but supervising animators usually are. There's a process to it. Probably starts as a bunch of rough sketches, and then, you know, it goes through this process of people looking at it, going, he's kind of tall, or he should be this, or should be that. And there's a refining process, usually with the director and like the what we call a character designer and the art director. And they come to a look for the character that everybody can agree on. I think this is, you know, this is like 80% there. But what also is happening is, you know, there's a story that's been written in the character as what his personality is like and what kind of character in our movie is the bad guy, is this, you know, he's got a lot of character attributes and stuff. They get kind of combined together. And then along the process, someone will pick, you know, somebody to do the voice. And then the voice actor will come in and, you know, read the lines from the script, and then add, you know, they'll add their personality to it. And so sometimes the character design gets tweaked a little bit to kind of like fit the voice. Eventually it all comes together.
To reiterate, the animators usually only start when the character has been fully developed and the voiceover has been recorded. With the rise of computers and the shift away from 2D animation as the main choice, Chris made sure to adapt and overcome.
I've done a fair share of CG animation. I started back in the early 2000s. Actually, these days, I probably do more storyboarding than I do traditional animation, but I do a fair amount. It's about, I'm going to say it's probably like 70-30, 70% hand-drawn and like 30% CG stuff that I do. I like it. I like doing CG stuff. It's a different discipline. Personally, I find the stuff that's hard to do in hand-drawn animation is easier to do in CG, and then there's stuff that's super hard to do in CG that's super easy to do in drawing. It's like, you know, the different disciplines of things. There were certain hand-drawn traditional animators that struggled with the transition to CG computer animation because they loved to draw, and drawing was such an intricate part of their love of what they did. I realized when I started to do CG that drawing for me, while I'm doing my job as an animator, the drawing part of it for me was a means to an end. It was a way to get the performance and the animation out. I wasn't in love with my drawings while I was doing them. I wasn't going, oh, these are beautiful. You know, I was working at it, you know. I'm just one of those guys that has to work at a drawing, and I keep working at it until it looks right. I'm not one of those guys that can just, you know, do a beautiful drawing, boom, just like that. So when I started doing CG stuff, it removed the work at the drawing. And I went, wow, I don't have to draw this. I could just grab it and move it, you know? And there was a freeing thing to that. It was like, wow. Of course, now you have other things where it's like, wow, I wish I could just draw this. It would be much faster. But the two different disciplines, they both worked for me. I'm more used to doing hand-drawn stuff, so I'm probably a little more comfortable with it. But I didn't stumble too much when I went into CG stuff because I was kind of not super attached to the drawing side of it.
In Mary Poppins Returns, there are scenes where live action is mixed in with 2D animation. Chris has a few words.
Even though when I did the Mary Poppins animation, I did it traditionally with pencil on paper, the old-fashioned way. But a lot of the animators worked in animation software, specifically TV Paint, it's called. Some people use what we call Toon Boom. But we have things called Cintiqs here, which are basically computer monitors that you can, you know, use a stylus and draw on like you would, you know, like your iPad Pro might do. But this is kind of like a bigger version of it. Yeah, that was a process. I had done it before on other films as well, but Mary Poppins one was probably the easiest time we've had doing it. And it wasn't, not to say it was easy, wasn't easy, but it was the easiest just because of the technology. And then of course we had some real good people there helping us out. But it was, again, a bit of a process. When they shot the live action, there was a lot of green screen stuff that they shot it with. And where the animated characters were going to be, they had a stand-in actor in a green suit saying the lines. Or sometimes it was like a puppet. like a horse's head on a stick that they're like moving around. And it's green, right? And so it gets matted out and everything. But that's what the actors are reacting to, and acting and reacting. And then sometimes it wasn't anything. They were just, they were just pretending something was there. The studio I work at in Pasadena is called Duncan Studio. Ken Duncan, who runs it, and Jim Capobianco, who was the animation director on Mary Poppins, they went over to England and sat in on the live action shoot as consultants for the animation. So they would sit off camera, and every now and then, if they saw something that was like, this might make it a little difficult, or this might create an issue when we're trying to animate it, they would speak up. And sometimes they would take their advice. Other times they would just say, no, we have to do it this way. But it was good for that, because so while they're shooting the live action, they are mindful that there are animated characters that are going to be added to it. And I have to give props to Emily Blunt, because she did a phenomenal job of acting without animated characters there, in a way that once you put the animated characters in, it looked great. She did a really great job. They've planned out and explained to the actors where the animated characters are going to be in this shot. Okay, this is what's happening. He's coming up here, and you got to talk. He's about this tall, and you got to talk to him like this. Then it's shot and it's sent to us to animate to it. So what we have is the raw footage, and you see them in the green screen, and we animate to it. Now, where the technology came in to help us out is that we could put it into compositing, and we could stabilize the live action footage, and we could stabilize it so that a certain point on screen stayed still, so that we could animate to that spot on screen without having, like if there was a handheld camera effect, or if the camera would, moved over a bit, we didn't have to animate the character moving over and try to keep him in field. We could just animate him in one place, and then it goes into the software. It would move the character once they take the stabilization out. The character suddenly looks like he's in the set, and it's amazing. Wow, that really works really well. That was a huge help. That's the technical side, and that worked out fairly well. There's the other side, which is the performance side of it, where the animator takes the character and they have to make that character act and behave like they're in the moment with Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins. Now, a few shots I did was when Mary Poppins lands in the animated world. So there were certain things I had to do with the character because the live action was already shot. And so if in the live action, there's in the script, of course, it's written as, there's a back and forth dialogue. Well, if Mary Poppins laughs or smiles, reacts, as the animator, I need to put something in my animation and time it right so that Mary Poppins' reaction looks natural and looks like it's supposed to be there, even though you're doing it all after the fact. So So there's a little bit of like a little bit of trickery going on there. There's a little bit of, you know, oh, okay, I can do this, and I'm gonna you're working the performance of the animated character to fit with stuff that is already shot.
A very insightful interview this was. Thanks a lot, Chris. If you want to see more of his work online, I suggest following him on his Instagram page at Chris, S-A-U-V-E, 25, where he posts a ton of drawings from his career. The Production Specialist is hosted by Black Dagger Audio, an audio production and post-production studio based in Dubai, UAE, specializing in custom sound design, original music, VO, and dialogue editing. You can visit our website for any project inquiries at blackdaggeraudio.com. If you have enjoyed listening to this podcast, there are three things that will help benefit this show. First is to share this with someone who has interest in the production industry. Second is to leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. And third is to support us on Patreon at patreon.com/productionspecialist. We have member exclusive benefits such as behind the scenes, bloopers, sitting in on live interviews, early access to episodes, and much, much more. And that is it. Thank you so much. See you next time.